talk about the define the standard cosmological model today. And my goal was to state the model, defining everything precisely. And I realized that I could not quite do that. There's one statement, the meaning of the adiabatic mode, where I'll have to hand wave a little bit and come back to it later. But I can mostly define the model precisely. So the standard model of cosmology is defined by these bullet points. The background metric is a lambda CDM FRW metric. On top of that background, that spatially homogeneous background, there are some perturbations, which are initially Gaussian random of a special type called scalar adiabatic that I'll define, with a particular power law spectrum given by this expression, where the parameters delta zeta squared and ns are free parameters of the model. The cosmological model has six parameters. Some people say you'll hear the term six parameter model. Three of these have been defined when we were talking about the FRW background. There was this cosmologist parameterization where the Hubble rate today, or the total energy density today, is parameterized by H in some unusual units. The omegas are the fraction of the universe today in various components. Cosmologists say baryonic matter, and that means protons and neutrons and electrons, just so that you know that in cosmology, an electron is called a baryon sometimes. These parameters appear in the power spectrum of the initial conditions. And then there's a parameter tau, the CMB optical depth, that I'll define in a few slides. So this slide just reviews the background. The universe is today is 69% cosmological constant, about 5% baryonic matter. The photon abundance is the precise value is a homework problem, but it's small today. And likewise for neutrinos. It's understood that the sum of the omegas is 1, so the amount that's missing here is understood to be the cold dark matter density, omega c. Omega c, when I enumerated the six parameters before, it was not listed as an independent parameter, so it can be derived from 26% cold dark matter. And then this is just reminding you of how the parameterization works. The energy density today is parameterized by H in these units, and the omegas are telling you the fraction of the energy density in each species. So that's the background. The initial conditions I'll start to define. At very early times, the initial conditions look like this. The metric is perturbed by this red term. So the spatial part of the metric here is factorizing as a function of time, the scale factor, times a function of space, which is the perturbation. And this function zeta is a Gaussian random field. As far as we know from analyzing many years of cosmological data, it's perfectly Gaussian. The initial conditions are perfectly Gaussian. And the power spectrum is usually parameterized like this. The combination k cubed over 2 pi squared we introduced yesterday and called it delta squared. It's the dimensionless power spectrum, or a dimensionless measure of the variance of the fluctuations per log k, variance per log k. This parameter delta zeta squared is just the value of the dimensionless power spectrum, k cubed b over 2 pi squared, evaluated at a certain reference number, 0.05 h inverse megaparsecs as a cosmological scale. Then the spectral index ns is defined in such a way that 1 would correspond to the scale invariant case, the case where k cubed b of k is constant. And it would probably make a little more sense if it were defined so that 0 is the scale invariant case, but this is the historical version. It's nearly equal to 1, but not quite. So the universe it is not quite true that the universe has no preferred scale. We do need dimensionful parameters to describe the initial conditions, but it's close to scale invariant. There's a small preference for more power on large scale. This field zeta is called the because it appears in the metric, it's called a curvature. The term adiabatic curvature is used, or sometimes initial curvature. So just to interpret this power spectrum a little bit, this combination KQP over 2 pi squared represents the square of the typical fluctuation size. So this value, 2.11 times 10 to the minus 9, means the characteristic size of the fluctuations is something like 5 times 10 to the minus 5. That would be, if you were an observer in the early universe, different observers would see the conditions of the early universe differ by roughly this amount, by a very small amount. So the initial conditions of the universe are kind of boring with a featureless power spectrum, not much scale dependence. Now here's the bit I have to hand wave at a little bit. So I said that the initial perturbations were scalar adiabatic, and I want to tell you what that means. Scalar is easy to state. It just means that there are the perturbation to the metric is just given by an overall scalar prefactor with no indices. There is no gravity wave type perturbation initially in the metric. At least as far as we know, some models of inflation predict that such a gravity wave background should exist, but so far it has not been observed. This is one of the interesting things that we'll try to see in cosmology in the next 5 or 10 years. The meaning of adiabatic is what I have to wave my hands at a little bit. What it means is that the zeta field, in addition to determining the perturbations in the metric, also determines perturbations in the stress energy tensor of every component by some universal set of rules that I'll explain later. For example, there's also a perturbation in the energy density that is proportional to zeta with a coefficient of 4.7. There is sort of a conceptual, I tried to find like a one line or like a one slide explanation of what was going on here, but it really needs like half an hour or so to explain. There is a symmetry reason why you would expect a particular pattern of coefficients to show up. Many symmetry arguments in physics have one-line summaries, like by rotation invariance, X is true. But this is not one of them. It's kind of a complicated symmetry argument. There's a symmetry argument involving, and the symmetry is the coordinate invariance of general relativity. By a complicated symmetry argument, it can be shown that at early times, there's a universal solution to the equations of motion that under certain conditions that I'll talk about later is expected to be an attractor solution. So you'd expect the universe to be in this so-called adiabatic mode. The best analogy that I could think of is you might think of Goldstone's theorem in particle physics that says that if a certain symmetry exists, a symmetry of the action which is spontaneously broken, then it follows that you have to have massless particles in the theory. That's not obvious. That's something that you have to work through the proof of Goldstone's theorem. Similar thing is going on here. Because of a certain symmetry, the gauge symmetry of GR, which is being spontaneously broken by the FRW metric, it turns out that the adiabatic mode exists and is computable. These coefficients are computable and is sometimes an attractor solution. So that's a hand-wavy explanation that I'll finish hopefully later in the class. The last thing that I have to tell you about is the meaning of this parameter, the CMB optical depth. And so I just want to tell a little story to explain that parameter. I have to tell this little story about the ionization history of the universe. This plot is showing as a function of time the ionization fraction, or the probability that a random electron in the universe is ionized versus being in an atom. And that starts out equal to 1 at very early times or high redshifts. The universe is very hot and is a plasma. When the temperature goes below a certain point, the electrons combine with protons to form neutral hydrogen. That's thermodynamically favored. And this, of course, is the formation of the time of the CMB, which is called recombination. Although combination would be a better name. I don't know why we have the re. Then the universe is transparent for a long time, and just cooling down during the Dark Ages. During this time, the small 10 to the minus 5 perturbations are growing by gravitational collapse. And eventually, by a process of messy astrophysics, the fluctuations become big enough that galaxies and stars form. And when stars form, the universe is full of high energy photons again, emitted in starlight. And that reionizes the neutral hydrogen. So almost all of the electrons in the universe today are ionized, not in neutral hydrogen atoms, and the ionization fraction is close to one. And tau is the CMB optical depth, is just the probability that a CMB photon emitted here, so it goes through the Dark Ages, and then it may or may not scatter off of an electron at low redshift after reionization. And tau is just the probability that a scattering occurred. So it's the optical depth of looking through all of the electrons in the late universe. It's about 0.06, so there's a 6% chance that when we see a CMB photon, it came directly from the surface of last scattering. And 94% chance, and a 6% chance that it was scattered. And this is just an astrophysical nuisance parameter. It affects the CMB power spectrum. So in order to fit the CMB power spectrum to the other cosmological parameters in the model, we need to include tau in the fit and also account for our uncertainty in tau when assigning errors to other parameters. So tau is, measuring tau is of limited independent interest, but we need to measure it to measure these parameters and others. It's actually a big nuisance. It's a nuisance parameter, and it's a big nuisance. For example, in future measurements of the neutrino mass from cosmology turn out to be, there's a good chance that they'll turn out to be limited by an accidental parameter degeneracy with tau. For this reason, I've personally written two papers proposing new ideas for statistics to constrain tau. So nobody likes tau, but we all have to think about it. So the standard cosmological model, the description of the perturbations is at very early times. It's just describing the perturbations in the initial conditions. And they're very simple. They're just parametrized by this, by adiabaticity. This one Gaussian random field, zeta, is setting initial conditions for all of the particle species and the degrees of freedom of the metric. It's kind of a... has an uninteresting featureless power spectrum. And this is processed by physics. So as time evolves, the perturbations become more complicated, more physics gets imprinted on the power spectrum. When the CMB is formed, all of the fluctuations are still small and the physics is still linear to an excellent approximation. But the power spectra have become very complex. So for example, if you could somehow directly measure the power spectrum of zeta in the initial conditions, you would only learn about two parameters in the model, the delta zeta parameter and NS, which is the slope of the that gives the k dependence of the power spectrum. But this power spectrum, the CMB power spectrum, is sensitive to all six cosmological. So it's kind of good that it makes life more complicated, but we also get to learn more by the presence of all this complex physics. Low redshifts, perturbations have grown gravitationally, nonlinear effects are important, and the perturbations are very non-Gaussian. And we get other interesting types of data sets, like galaxy clustering data sets and gravitational lensing. And then there's also models for the early universe, which so the way that I phrase the standard cosmological model, the initial conditions are just an assumption. They're part of the model is just assumed. There are also models like inflation that hypothesize a phase of the universe prior to its radiation-dominated phase can try to produce zeta as a final condition and explain where this Gaussian field came from and why it has the power spectrum that it does. Each of these three arrows are different, represent different stages of the universe with different physics. If we're talking about the early universe, then we're doing quantum mechanics in an expanding space-time, trying to explain where the Gaussian perturbations came from via quantum mechanical effects. Formation from the CMB is a very complicated linear problem where we are describing linear acoustic waves in a plasma with many components. And metric degrees of freedom are also important. GR effects are important. And then at late times, there are fewer degrees of freedom in the problem, but they're nonlinear. So we're just thinking about the nonlinear gravitational collapse of an n-body system, plus a lot of messy astrophysics, things like galaxy formation and star formation are very messy. So each of these three arrows is sort of an independent topic, and that's convenient for the Sci 3-week format, because every year I can pick an arrow and just talk about a third of it. Finally, I don't want to convey the impression that all of cosmology is just shrinking error bars on six parameters. What we're really interested in is figuring out whether the six-parameter model is all there is to the story, or whether one of these extensions of the six-parameter model is needed. Many of the ingredients in the standard model were once extensions. They were surprises, like dark matter, cosmological constant, or the existence of quantum mechanical initial conditions. When I started doing cosmology in like 2002, we had a five-parameter model. The parameter NS was added in 2006. We'd like to, by looking for these extensions and others, understand the phenomena, the surprises that we already know about, and see if there are more surprises. So if you're a theorist, you might be a cosmological theorist, you might be asking the question, have we parameterized every possible surprise, or are there more things that we should be asking the observers to look for? And if you're an observer, you might be trying to shrink error bars or think about designing experiments or new statistics to measure these. I thought it would be useful to give that description of the cosmological model, and also just to kind of explain in cartoons like how cosmology works. So next I want to go back to the blackboard and talk about something a little different. By the way, I forgot to ask if there were any questions. I usually start by asking if there are questions on the homework or previous lecture.
I have a question regarding this.
Oh, yeah.
Can you explain a bit this scale preference for large scale? I mean, NS being almost one, but not really one.
Oh, yeah, that just means that this power spectrum. So if this were constant, then the universe would be scale invariant. Meaning that there's no preferred scale, and an observer, if we took the initial conditions in a box and took a small subbox and blew it up to the size of the original box, we would get something statistically indistinguishable. Because it slowly runs with scales. This would be the value of the power spectrum or the characteristic fluctuation size at a particular scale, 0.05 inverse megaparsecs. But if you looked on a slightly larger scale, you would see slightly larger characteristic fluctuation. So that's the sense in which there is a scale dependence or a preferred scale. You could imagine, for example, extrapolating this power law out to some very large scale where the fluctuations become of order one. That's just a direct way of seeing that there's some preferred length scale in our universe.
And we see this in the CMB?
That's right, yeah. That's right. Okay. So, So the next thing that I want to talk about is statistics. And the thing that I really want to get to is something called the Fisher matrix, which is a very ubiquitous tool in cosmology. I would say something like a third of the papers, the cosmology papers on the archive, are largely or partially concerned with computing something called a Fisher matrix. So I'm going to tell you what this matrix is and why we're all obsessed with it. I like this. I like the ground-up approach. So I'm going to start by, for maybe half a lecture or so, just talking generally about statistics in cosmology. I want to start with a toy example, which is the example of a biased coin. Consider this question. Coin is flipped 100 times. And 70 heads result. The question is, how can we decide, is it plausible that the coin is unbiased? That is that the, let's call theta the probability of heads, is equal to 0.5. There's more than one correct way to answer this question, because there's more than one way of doing statistics. I'll comment that statistics, the big division is statistical methods tend to be either frequentist or Bayesian. And I want to start out by talking about the frequentist approach to statistics. This will be the frequentist bias coin. Let me phrase the question this way. Suppose that you're a lawyer, and you have to argue in court that the coin is probably biased. And you don't know how much math the jury knows, so you want to present the argument that is the most direct and streamlined without appealing to mathematical machinery. How might you, in that situation, argue that the coin must be biased?
You say you would expect 50 outcomes,
70 is the outcome. How do you know that? That's true. How do you know that 70 is too large to be a statistical clue? Like, if you wanted to convince yourself that it's too large to be a statistical clue, what might you do? So that is a totally correct answer, although it's it is making the approximation that the distribution of heads is Gaussian. That's a totally okay approximation here, because n is 100, and the central limit theorem will have Gaussianized things. What's a direct argument that would not make that approximation or require anyone to know about Gaussian statistics or sigma? So one thing that you might do is just simulate repetitions of the experiment. If I simulate experiments, I did this on the computer, where one experiment is 100 coin flips. Assuming a fair coin, and count the fraction of the time that you end up with 70 heads or more. It makes more sense to fraction of the time that the outcome is greater than or equal to 70. It makes more sense here to use a greater than or equal, count the fraction of the time that you're at least as much of an outlier as the observed result. rather than counting the fraction of the time that you get exactly 7. So I did this, and I got a very small number, less than 10 to the minus 4. So that's a very direct statistical argument that this would be unlikely, this outcome would be unlikely if the coin is fair. Now, just to introduce some notation, and the frequentist approach to statistics is just sort of based on generalizing this type of thing. So just to introduce some notation, this quantity, the probability of, this is called the conditional probability. Of x given y, or probability of outcome x given assumption y. This would be written as saying that the probability of getting h greater than or equal to 70, assuming that theta is 0.5, is 6.5 times 10 to the minus 4. One issue that often comes up in statistics is the issue of assigning trial factors. Here's a CMB example. I took the CMB power spectrum, which is measured by, I used WMAP for this, an old experiment, but that's OK. WMAP measures for every integer value of L, measures the CMB power spectrum CL. And if you stare at this curve, you'll see that the 901st multipole looks fishy, it looks high. And the probability of getting this, if you follow this approach and simulate the WMAP experiment, assuming that the theory curve is the truth, then the probability of getting that result turns out to be 6.4 times 10 to the minus 4, a very small number. But of course, this number doesn't account for the fact that there were 1,000 different or so different L's that I was implicitly looking at when I eyeballed this curve and picked out the high one. So I wouldn't take this probability at face value and say that it represents a real disagreement with the theory. I'd want to sort of multiply in my head by if I were just doing things informally by a factor of 1,000. And then if you think about it, each, not only were there 1,000 multipoles that each had a chance to be anomalous, but each one had the chance to either be anomalously high or anomalously low. So it would really make most sense to multiply by a trial factor of 2,000. And then you get 64%, a probability of order 1. Having one multipole anomalous at this level is completely expected. And the issue of trial factors is always tricky, like especially in cosmology, where we just measure one realization of, say, the CMB, and we don't get to repeat the experiment and measure an independent CMB. So just for fun, an example is the cold spot in the CMB. In the CMB sky, there's a particular feature which is very, very visually suggestive. A few degrees wide, where the temperature is much lower than the average. And it's hard to say what trial factor you should assign to this, because there are many locations in the sky where you could have seen the cold spot. There are also, we would be having the same conversation if we had seen a cold spot that was of a different size. So you should also probably assign some sort of trial factor to the size. And then those are reasonably straightforward things to quantify. But then there's also things like, we weren't specifically expecting to see a spot. We'd probably be having the same discussion if we had seen a cold ring or cold stripe or something. And so the issue of assigning, determining a trial factor and assigning statistical significance to like an unexplained weird excursion or an unexpected weird excursion is a lot fuzzier and involves more judgment than you might think. This thing, the cold spot, was noticed in like 2003 or something, and I personally don't find it convincing, but about half the cosmology community disagrees with me. So in this example, you know, if we were trying to decide whether this value was consistent with the coin being fair, in my opinion, it would make sense to multiply this by a factor of 2 to account for the fact that it could have fluctuated high or low. Just as an aside, I described this as if I was running computer simulations to get this probability. In this example, you can compute it analytically. The probability of getting k heads given an assumed value of theta is 100 choose k times theta to the k times 1 minus theta to the n minus k. 100 minus k. That's because the probability of getting k heads, there were k coin flips that had to come up heads and 100 minus k that had to come up tails. And then this binomial coefficient represents the number of ways of ordering them, the number of different orderings of the heads and tails that would have k heads. So we argued that 0.5, theta equals 0.5 is not very plausible. And we can turn that into a procedure for determining the smallest plausible value of theta. What we would do is we would take this number that we computed, the probability of having 70 or more heads given an assumed value of theta. So that was small at 0.5. And then we would just compute it as a function of theta and threshold it at some reasonable value. I'll choose 2.5%. I'll explain why in a minute. I did this calculation. So when computing the probability of getting 70 or more heads, you would just take this expression and sum it over k greater than or equal to 70. I plotted that and I found that the value where p crossed 0.025 was 0.6. If I continued this curve, then it would peak at 0.7, of course. And then on the other side, it would make more sense to plot the probability of getting 70 or fewer heads given an assumed high value of theta. And on the other side, this threshold probability of 2.5% is crossed at 0.788. This range of values, theta between 0.6 and 0.788, is what's called the 95% confidence region, confidence interval. Meaning that, and what it means is that if you're outside this interval, then a simulated experiment would give a result that was as extreme as the observed data, 5% of the time or fewer. The trial factor of 2 that I talked about previously has been included, so that's why the 95% confidence interval corresponds to 2.5%. Sometimes people use language like one-sided confidence interval or two-sided confidence interval to indicate explicitly whether you're including a trial factor of 2. And in more complicated examples, you might include a more complicated trial factor. So this is based on thresholding the p-value. Is the statistics terminology for the function of theta that's on the plot. But namely, the probability of getting 70 or more heads if theta is less than 0.7, or the probability of getting 70 or fewer heads if theta is greater than 0.7. Frequentist statistics is always based on thresholding p-values to determine which models are allowed. And a p-value is always defined as the probability of getting a particular outcome or something more extreme with trial factors included, arising as a statistical proof. Okay. Next, I want to talk about Bayesian statistics. Let's talk about the Bayesian bias coin. So Bayesian statistics is always a four-step process. The first step is to choose a prior. A prior probability distribution, or PDF. It's part of the philosophy of Bayesian statistics that everything has a probability distribution. And in particular, before I look at the result of the experiment, before I do the coin flips, I have to have some sort of implicit prior probability distribution on the parameter theta. So I'll make the choice that this is going to be a uniform prior. So the probability of a given value of theta is 1 if theta is between 0 and 1 and 0 outside. Now you calculate the probability. The conditional probability of obtaining the data D, whatever measurement you took, assuming a particular set of model parameters. Here there's only one model parameter. So that is, in this example, there's an analytic formula for it. The probability of getting the data, assuming a given value of theta. The data here is the number 70. Is this. And there's no inequality here. We're just asking for the probability of getting exactly whatever it was that we observed. Then you update the prior to get the posterior PDF. This is your updated probability distribution on the model parameter theta after looking at the outcome of the experiment. And it's written like this as a conditional probability with the arguments reversed. It's supposed to be Now, the probability that the true value of the heads probability is theta, given the observation of the data d. And that updating step is always done by Bayes' theorem. Which says that the posterior probability posterior probability distribution is obtained by multiplying the prior times the probability of getting the data, and then just normalizing the result so that it has integral 1 and is a probability distribution. So in this example, we would take our prior, which is 1, multiply it by the conditional probability, which is computed there. And then divide by the integral of that. Notice that the binomial coefficient turned out to cancel. Often, when doing these calculations, I don't write the denominator explicitly. I just calculate with the proportional to sign, so that I can drop things like overall constants throughout the calculation. So you could write the result like this, and then just remember that at the end of the calculation, you put in whatever constant makes it have integral 1. And all right, and then lastly, you just assign confidence regions. Based on this being the probability distribution for theta. So this posterior, you know, before I took the measurement, I had some prior that said that theta could be anything. And then I took the measurement, and I have some non-trivial function of theta, which peaks at 0.7. And to assign a confidence region based on that probability distribution, there's actually more than one prescription. But a prescription that I like is just to normalize it so that it has integral 1, and then integrate the tail until you accumulate a probability of 0.025 to get endpoints. When that procedure is done, I did that on the computer for this function p of theta, and I found that I accumulated 2.5% of the integral when the lower endpoint was 0.604, and the upper interval was 0.781. The 0.025 is, again, supposed to account for the trial factor of 2. In this problem, the Bayesian and frequentist analyses gave slightly different 95% confidence regions on theta. And that's OK, because they are both slightly different internally consistent formalisms that differ slightly in what they mean by a confidence region or how a probability is supposed to be interpreted. It may help to say that, one more comment I wanted to make is that Bayes' theorem is really intuitive, and you might use it without realizing that you're invoking a theorem. It just says that if I have some prior probability distribution and then I make an observation, I just reweight the odds in proportion to the probability of getting that observation. So for example, if I wake up in the morning and I don't know whether it's raining or not, I might say there's a 10% chance of rain. So at that point, My prior odds are 1 to 9 that it's raining or not raining. And now let's say that I like hear some thunder out my window. And that can happen even if it's not raining. It's just 5 times more likely to happen if it's raining. Then I would update the odds to 5-9. Meaning that the new probability is, and then I normalize to a probability distribution. So my new probability of rain is 5/14. Bayes' theorem just says you just update your odds in proportion to the probability of giving whatever you observe, and then just normalize those odds back to a probability distribution. When thinking about statistics, this comment may be helpful. At least I find it helpful. The word probability can mean two different things. We use the same word, I think, for two slightly different concepts. One thing a probability sometimes means is the frequency of occurrence in a repeated experiment. And that's always what it means in the frequentist context. But another thing that a probability can mean is a degree of belief. Like when we make a probabilistic statement like, given our observations of our analysis of cosmological data, it is very improbable that the neutrino mass is larger than 0.2 eV. There's no repeated experiment such that the neutrino mass is larger than 0.2 eV with some frequency and less with some frequency. What that statement is quantifying is our degree of belief. There's only one neutrino mass, and we're quantifying our degree of belief that it's mass. If you think about it, those two concepts, degree of belief and frequency of occurrence, are slightly different things. And in Bayesian statistics, the prior and posterior probabilities always mean degree of belief, and a conditional probability means frequency of occurrence. Another way of thinking about degree of belief is that it represents like a gambling odds. So a way that you could interpret the Bayesian confidence region here is that if someone wants to bet with me, and they want to bet that the true value of theta is inside this interval, and on my side of the bet, I'm forced to bet that it's outside this interval, then the threshold odds where I would accept that bet are 20 to 1. If they're offering me odds that are higher than that, then I would accept it. Over here, the frequency confidence region represents something different. It just says that if you're outside that interval, the probability of getting the observed value in a repeated experiment would be a below some threshold value. So they're both just, the fact that they disagree just arises from the fact that the confidence interval means two slightly different things. You might think that the Bayesian and frequentist approaches are like not really all that different. There is in fact sort of a holy war where statisticians tend to put themselves in one camp or the other and like write papers that insult each other. I personally try to be an agnostic, but most of the time I tend to prefer Bayesian statistics. I'm like a Bayesian-leaning agnostic. I would say that they, both are internally consistent, but just differ slightly in what they mean by probability in certain contexts or confidence region in certain contexts. And just have, I think the advantages and disadvantages are sort of technical and context-dependent. In this problem for the random coin, I actually think I like the frequentist approach a little bit better. Just because if you're trying to, imagine you're trying to explain to someone who didn't know any statistics what the confidence region meant, then the story that you tell is very simple. If you're outside the confidence region, it's improbable that you would get the observed result, like one sentence. In the Bayesian approach, you have to tell this more complicated story where you start with the philosophy that everything has a probability distribution, and then you update it, and you have these betting odds. It's a more complicated story. What I like about the Bayesian approach is that it tends to be very formal and unambiguous. In the frequentist approach, one thing that one source of difficulty that's obscured in this simple problem is that you're always trying to quantify consistency between a model and an observation based on whether some number is above or below a certain threshold. And here there was, in the example of coin flips, there's only one number that is reasonable to look at, and that is the observed number of heads. In a more complicated example, like say theta suppose the data now is a CMB map, and the parameter theta is the Hubble parameter. And you're trying to decide what number distills a CMB map down into an estimate of the Hubble parameter. That's a complicated question, and so the choice of summary statistic or estimator is often unclear how to construct one or what the best choice is. And so there's some choice that here that is a source of difficulty that doesn't exist over here. Another advantage of the Bayesian formalism is that for problems involving many parameters, here there was just one parameter, there's a lot of mathematical techniques that make the Bayesian approach technically easier and more computationally efficient than this frequency-based approach. So in problems involving large numbers of variables, and even like the six parameters of the standard cosmological model is probably already enough parameters. This is really the more practical choice, and doing the frequentist analysis would actually be much more different. The potential disadvantage of the Bayesian method, the thing to watch out for, is that the results can sometimes depend on the choice of prior. And because this is just a choice. Roughly the way it works is that if the data are constraining enough, then the dependence of the prior error is not very important. Like if this is a narrow peak, I do multiply by the prior. But if this peak is narrow and the prior is fairly slowly varying, as long as it's a reasonable prior that varies slowly, that multiplication step isn't going to change the shape much, and the choice of prior will drop out. But in complicated problems, like with many nuisance parameters, where maybe there's some hidden combination of parameters that is poorly constrained by the data, then you can get into a tricky territory where the Bayesian likelihood is preferring some parts of the parameter space to others, but that could only be because they have more prior volume, not necessarily because the data prefers them. Statistics can be tricky, and the choice of which approach to use can be non-trivial. I have a bunch more statistics to talk about, ending with talking about the Fisher matrix and what it means for cosmology, but this is a good place to stop for today.